You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Credo Mobile. With Credo, your voice reflects your values. Check out credomobile.com/majority for details.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 27th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, part of our best of 2012 week. I'm still on vacation. I've had almost 4 days off. What am I doing with myself? I know what I'm doing. Whatever my wife, Nikki, my expectant wife, Nikki, has told me to do, which probably involves a lot of obsessive cleaning. You know, the one thing that I've noticed about women who are pregnant, they demand a lot of cleaning. And of course, they can't do it because they're pregnant. So I end up doing it. But I'm not complaining, ladies and gentlemen. It's nice to have a little bit of time away, but that doesn't mean that we don't have a great show for you today. First up, from May 24th, a conversation with Thomas Drake, a whistleblowing former NSA employee, and his attorney, Jesselyn Raddick, the director of National Security and Human Rights at the Government Accountability Project. And then also an interview I did with Senator Sheldon Whitehouse in June at Netroots Nation on the grand bargain in Citizens United. And if I'm not mistaken, the senator said at that time, no touching Social Security. Has he kept his promise? We shall see. And of course, continuing our 2012 best of, you'll get a sprinkling of libertarian callers or monologues, whatever. I don't know. Whatever Matt has concocted for you. So,
and I've concocted something good.
Wait, where are you talking from? Oh, there you are. All right. So, folks, enjoy it. Remember, we will be back on Monday, the 31st, with another best of 2012. Two great environmental authors. From different parts of the environmental spectrum in terms of direct action and science. So you will enjoy that, Derek Jensen and Michael Mann. And then on the first New Year's Day, Corey Robin on his book, The Reactionary Mind, and Richard Wolff on When Capitalism Fails. So more great offerings for you in 2012. I hope that you had wonderful holidays. I continue to hope that, and I hope that you will have a good New Year's, but I will talk to you tomorrow. Well, not really tomorrow. I'll talk to you in just moments in real time, but in future time, it'll be tomorrow. Don't ask me to explain that. We'll be right back.
You made me untouchable for life. Yeah, yeah. And you wasn't alone. It hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton.
Okay, we are back. Sam Suter on the Majority Report. On the phone, we have the NSA whistleblower, Thomas Drake, and his attorney, Jesselyn Raddick, who is also the author of her just-released book, Traitor and the American Taliban. Thomas, Jesselyn, are you there?
Yeah.
Yes, you are.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Appreciate your patience as we had a little bit of technical difficulty. Jesselyn, let's start with you. I want to. You not only represented Thomas Drake in his case brought against him by the U.S. government for espionage, but you also were a whistleblower yourself. Tell us briefly your story.
Yes, I had been the Justice Department ethics attorney in the case of the so-called American Taliban, John Walker Lind. This was shortly after 9/11, and I had advised not to interrogate him without counsel and certainly not to torture him. And when the FBI did so anyway, I advised that that information would have to be sealed and not used for a criminal prosecution. Again, my advice was ignored, and evidence of that advice was withheld from the court. At that point, I blew the whistle, and the Lind case collapsed shortly thereafter. But for me, the journey had just begun because I was subject to all sorts of retaliation, including being put under criminal investigation myself, being referred to the state bars in which I'm licensed as an attorney, and being put on the no-fly list. Because of that experience, that led me into representing whistleblowers because I knew what they were going through. And I didn't want anyone to have to go through what I went through. And eventually, working at the Government Accountability Project, that's all I do, is represent whistleblowers. And I came to represent Thomas Drake when the government brought charges against him, the fourth person in U.S. history against whom the government has brought charges for espionage against a non-spy, under the Espionage Act for allegedly mishandling classified information.
And while simultaneous to, or very close at least in time, as you were, and we should make it clear that your advice on the Lind case was solicited. I mean, they were holding John Walker Lind in Afghanistan, and your advice was solicited. They were perfectly aware that he had counsel at that time. You suggested that you told them that you cannot interrogate this man without that counsel, and they went ahead and did it, like you said. Anyways, and then claimed after the fact that they weren't aware of that. Meanwhile, I guess across town, Thomas, you were working for the NSA. Tell us what your job was.
Well, I was hired in a special outside hiring program. Kind of stir up the gene pool. There have been a lot of pressure put on NSA to bring in people from outside NSA, people that had not been brought up at NSA, were not promoted from within the system, particularly from Congress. So about a dozen of us were hired during the spring-summer of 2001. And so I answered an ad that was actually placed in the Washington Post. I was ultimately offered a position, and my first day on the job, and the title was Senior Change Leader. And I was reporting to the number three person, Maureen Baginski, who headed up the Signals Intelligence Directorate at the time. 9/11 was my first actual day on the job.
Wow. And at that time, you came to essentially to see that the NSA had material, had all sorts of data that, in your words, could have prevented 9/11. Is that right?
Oh, yes. I mean, that was the first thing I discovered shortly after 9/11 is the sheer amount of information that NSA had, what they also knew about the information, but also later what they didn't know they had. It was very deep inside their data banks. And information that if it had gotten out and been shared with the rest of the government in the manner in which it was supposed to have been shared by NSA, I will say could have easily have prevented, blunted the 9/11 attacks.
And
I was being given...
And why do you feel that that material never was shared? I mean, was there a statutory firewall or what was it?
No, they had standing regulations and provisions in which they were to share what's called actionable intelligence, indications and warning, information that when brought to the highest level of the government is the type of information you then take action on. They had that critical information in their databanks prior to 9/11. Now, I didn't discover this until after 9/11. There was people coming to me, and when I was later during one of the 9/11 congressional investigations trying to figure out what had gone wrong in the government in terms of preventing, when the government was unable to prevent the attack, they started doing a lot of inquiries, and I was contacted as a material witness to provide critical information to a couple of different congressional investigations. During those investigations, I shared with them information that NSA had prior to 9/11 regarding al-Qaeda that had never been shared outside of NSA. In fact, they had prohibited the sharing of this critical information because, as I found out later, they didn't know what others would do with it. And so they decided to hold and retain it, to hoard the information rather than share the information.
And
kind of a pathological cultural condition.
And when you testified to those two committees, the House and Senate Permanent Select Committees on Intelligence, you were required by law, obviously, to testify to these committees.
Well, I was actually contacted by investigators, both the Sachse-Shambliss subcommittee, it was a brand new committee that had been formed recently at that time under HPSI. I'd also been in contact prior to those investigations with other HPSI and CISI staffers. And then I was also called to material witness for the much larger investigation that precipitated in the spring and summer of 2002. And so I was a material witness. They had subpoena power. I was actually providing them significant amounts of information, some of it highly classified information, about what NSA knew, could have known, or should have known regarding the 9/11 perpetrators.
And how would you characterize the data that the NSA had at that time? And I believe this is under the program known as Trailblazer. Is that correct?
Well, Trailblazer never actually delivered anything. It's important to note that. That was a flagship program that was launched with great fanfare in the spring of 2000. It was supposed to bring NSA into the digital age. It failed abysmally, but it spent multiple billions of dollars attempting to do so for something that had already been solved by the very best of American ingenuity and innovation called FinThread, a program that had been developed with only a few millions of dollars by essentially a skunkworks team, a high-performing skunkworks team, who decided in the mid-90s to take on the great challenges of NSA, which one of them was, the critical challenge, how do you make sense of data when you have so much information at hand? How do you make sense of all that? And so they took it on, they solved the core challenge problem, and they were ready to deploy FinThread on a worldwide basis well prior to 9/11, but NSA would not let them do that.
And how would you...
So Trailblazer was just a funding vehicle, that's all it was. It died an abysmal death in the 2005-2006 timeframe.
How would you characterize the information that NSA had at that time relative to its parameters as to what it was allowed to gather in terms of information on Americans?
Well, now you're in that's the other thing that I discovered. Shortly after 9/11, a critical decision was made with far-reaching implications. It opened up the Pandora's box. You have to remember there was lots of illegal surveillance by the American government during the 50s and 60s and 70s, culminating in the Nixon administration. And so they had the Frank Church and the Pike Committee hearings during that period in the 70s that ultimately led, which uncovered a lot of the surveillance and illegal activity and monitoring Americans who were legitimately expressing their First Amendment rights and also violating their Fourth Amendment rights. So they formed the two standing intelligence committees to provide oversight of the secret side of government. They also put into law during the Carter administration in 1978 a statute called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was the exclusive means by which the U.S. government could conduct surveillance with a warrant, although there were hot pursuit options. They still have to go back at the warrant later in a rather short period of time, but could not conduct electronic surveillance on any basis without a warrant issued by that court. That was modified five times prior to 9/11. After 9/11, they chose to completely bypass that statute, and they entered into a very, very secret program in which NSA became the executive agent, a program now known, I knew it then, but it's become out in public, called Stellar Wind, which was became a vast dragnet electronic surveillance program across the United States domestically.
So, Jesselyn, when Thomas goes and reports to the various entities, whether it was Senate or House committees or to the DOD Inspector General, to essentially whistleblow, outline for us on, what actions he took that should have been covered under U.S. law and protection for whistleblowers.
That acts that are lawfully covered are certainly reporting to his superiors, reporting to the inspector generals are protected by the Inspector General Act of 1978, and reporting to Congress is protected by the Intelligence Community's Whistleblower Protection Act as well as the First Amendment. He reported to all of the proper internal channels, and I've never seen a whistleblower who so appropriately and properly reported through the official channels, yet all of them failed him.
And so all of those whistleblower channels failed him, and ultimately, was it that reporting that became the basis for the government's attempt to prosecute Thomas under the Espionage Act?
Yes, totally inappropriately. The government used protected disclosures that Mr. Drake had made to the Department of Defense Inspector General as the basis for the Espionage Act counts against him. So in a way, he was completely double-crossed by the office and agency that was supposed to protect him. Now, that office and agency actually did a long report over 2.5 years, which found in favor of Drake and the other whistleblowers. There were four other whistleblowers, yet they classified that report immediately, so it was not available to the public. And meanwhile, when the Justice Department decided to start so-called leak investigations for how its secret domestic warrantless wiretapping program, which was illegal, how that got out, the Defense Department Inspector General apparently turned over the names of Tom and the other people who had lawfully complained.
Now, and Jesselyn, the your experience versus Thomas's in terms of, I want to get a sense of how different members of Congress reacted. I know that in your case, Jesselyn, when you were being essentially prosecuted or at the very least persecuted by the Department of Justice in some respects for blowing the whistle on the fact that John Lynn Walker had an attorney, that the Department of Justice was aware that he had an attorney, and they ignored that
and therefore essentially tainted any evidence, in addition to the way that they treated him, tainted any evidence for use in a criminal trial. My understanding is, according to your book, Traitor and the Whistleblower, the Whistleblower and the American Taliban, that the late Senator Kennedy at least intervened in some respect on your behalf. Is that correct?
That's correct. I was very grateful for that because as a Washington, D.C. resident, I don't have a voting member in Congress. So I was very fortunate that he intervened. But in Tom's case, it was radio silence. Congress at the highest levels was fully aware of Tom Drake's predicament, and nobody intervened, which is very cowardly and unfortunate. Basically, Congress is supposed to do oversight over these agencies, and here, not only were they not overseeing the agency, they weren't overseeing the agency when it was acting completely ultra-virus and outside the scope of what it was allowed to do in terms of harassing somebody.
Thomas, I mean, tell me about that part of your journey here. I mean, at different points, you are reaching out to different authorities, whether it is or in fact not even reaching out, being called in to talk to different authorities and to provide them information that they're seeking. In some instances, you're talking to committee chairs, you're talking to committee staffers. In other instances, you're talking to your immediate superior at the NSA, who essentially, and my understanding is that you're the director of signals intelligence, who was the number three person at NSA, who you worked for, Maureen Baginski, instead of helping you in providing this information that was your responsibility to provide for her, she was upset that you had provided her this information, correct?
Well, there's any number of incidents. There's the one in which I actually provided her this very long-range study about Al-Qaeda and associated movements. It had never been released to the rest of the government, but had been finished well prior to 9/11. I actually brought it to her attention when it was brought to my attention by very concerned analysts not long after 9/11, and she actually looked at it and said, I wish you had never brought this to my attention. She needed plausible deniability. In early 2002, she actually pulled me inside and warned me in no uncertain terms that they were looking for leakers, not leakers to the press, you know, not leakers to people that are unauthorized to receive any government information or class information, but leakers to the congressional investigators looking into what NSA knew, could have known, or should have known prior to 9/11. So, you know, the message was very clear. When I was then contacted in early 2003 by the Department of Defense Inspector General, auditors, investigators regarding Trailblazer and ThinThread. I remember telling him right up front I was extraordinarily concerned about retaliation or reprisal by virtue of me having contact with them. And they said, well, if you're reprised against by NSA, you know, you can actually submit a reprisal complaint and we will investigate it, because you cannot be reprised for cooperating, because they have the speed of power too, with an official investigation that actually went on for well over, it's almost 2.5 years for that particular investigation. So, yes, I was fully compromised. The irony of my case, the central charges that the government issued, when I was indicted in April of 2010, there were 10 counts. There was 5 counts under the Espionage Act, but the centerpiece of their charges, the details of which remain sealed, but I can share this with you, were in whole or in part the actual documents that they alleged that I retained for the purposes of disclosure, which is not even in the law, by the way. Those particular documents, in whole or in part, were provided to the Department of Defense Inspector General investigators. So, and I had been asked to retain anything I could. Of course, I wasn't going to retain anything classified. I did retain a fair amount of unclassified material, and the reason was in case they ever needed, they had to do follow-up, or there's additional questions for the record, I would at least have some way to be able to recreate some of what I had provided to them as part of protected communications. So isn't it ironic that the very basis of their case gay, in terms of the Espionage Act charges, was centered on information that I actually provided to them as protected communication as part of an official government investigation.
Right, and had you withheld those documents from them? I mean, so these documents were you were required to give them these documents, and then the fact that and they told you to hold on to them, and then the fact that you hold on to them became the basis of their charges against you.
Yes, that is correct, and that the reason. Yes, yes.
And we should also, I just want to put a fine point
on this. And by the way, those documents were never shared. It's important to note for your listening audience, those documents were never shared with anybody except the investigators, period. None.
So essentially, the charges were amounted to charging you for providing them to government investigators.
Yes.
And I want to...
Yes, although what they have... I did have contact with a reporter later. I was so... Because I'll remember, as Jesslyn just said a short time ago, all of my whistleblowing, both internal to NSA and outside of NSA, within proper government channels, protected communication channels, all came to naught. So when the 2005 Blockbuster article came out, written by Risen and Wickbauer, reviewing for the first time at least one portion of this much larger Dragnet surveillance program, which was illegal to begin with, which the government conveniently labeled the terror surveillance program, when that story hit, I knew that there was others that knew, but I also knew that there was far more to the story and that there was a much, much larger program. And I also knew, if I had made that case internally after 9/11 and to the investigators, there was a legal alternative, would have provided superior intelligence and would have provided all the protections to Americans under the Fourth Amendment and was fully compliant with FISA.
All right, so
it was never necessary to go to the dark side.
So, Jesslyn, we've heard the characterization of essentially testifying to Congress as leaking within the context of the NSA. I want to ask you, in your experience at the Department of Justice, was there a similar perspective, I guess? Was there a similar culture of that if you were to testify in proper channels, if you were to cooperate with investigators within proper channels, did the DOJ have the same sort of, I guess, culture which perceived that as leaking? Because, of course, that's not leaking by any stretch of the manner, but if you characterize it as leaking, it presupposes that what you're doing is wrong. Did the Department of Justice have a similar culture, do you think?
Yes, it had, at the time, set up an anti-leak task force shortly after 9/11. And it had an inspector general, again, whom you could lawfully go to with complaints and supposedly be protected. I did go to the inspector general of my agency and also ended up being retaliated against in spades. The difference between my case and Tom's is that, for me, the retaliation entailed being placed under criminal investigation, referred to the state bars in which I'm licensed, and being put on the no-fly list. Bush treated whistleblowers unmercifully, but Obama took it to a whole new level by criminally prosecuting them.
And I definitely want to get to that part of it, but I want to ask you both, and let's start with you, Jesslyn. What is it about these agencies that ostensibly are designed to protect Americans that are the Department of Justice? I mean, it's called the Department of Justice. What is it about these agencies that perceive this type of cooperation, of actually working within the context of the system, and certainly in Thomas's case would have provided far more efficiency and legality, it sounds like, in our intelligence gathering? What is it about these agencies that end up looking upon that normal functioning as being criminal?
You know, I think it's a very warped bureaucratic response. You know, and often the target of the inspector general becomes not the person against whom the complaint was lodged, but the person who made the complaint, him or herself. And I think it's this defensive agency reaction. They say they're open to hearing dissent, you know, and criticism, particularly about fraud, waste, abuse, and illegality. But then when people actually do that, they are treated as the problem. Now, I think that happens in big bureaucracies in the government. I think it happens at large corporations. But I think there's very much a groupthink mentality to go along and get along and not to rock the boat, or else you know, if you didn't have that bureaucratic mentality, as I call it, you probably wouldn't be working at a place like the Justice Department or Enron. But certainly setting up these sham systems that are meant to protect whistleblowers internally end up functioning as basic entrapment when people trust that by going there, those offices are actually going to do something.
And Thomas, particularly, I would think, like, the only circuit breaker here is theoretically is those members of Congress who are theoretically not within the context of those bureaucracies, and ostensibly are supposed to be providing oversight for those bureaucracies. What do you think? Why do you think there was such cowardice on the part of all those staffers, all those Congress people, all those senators who were aware of your testimony, who required your testimony? When it came time to actually defend you for providing that information, they didn't. What do you think what was motivating them?
They made a political calculus that it was better to fold with the national security state and those that were in charge of it and give them the benefit of the doubt than to actually pursue the very troubling information that I was bringing to their attention, and particularly the information regarding the massive fraud, waste, and abuse and the illegalities. I gave it to them on a silver platter. It was laid out in great detail, time, place, and circumstance.
And where
and
is
so
that?
In the end, they.
Where is that information now? Who has that information? I mean, is there anybody? Go ahead.
All those details were given to the investigators, all of them. I mean, reams of information. We're talking, you know, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of pages of prima facie evidence. But, you know, NSA was largely let off the hook, interestingly enough. A lot of attention was given to the CIA and the FBI and other parts of the government, but NSA's culpability in 9/11, and never mind, you know, they kind of doubled down after 9/11, as I was told, you know, informed internally 9/11 by the, you know, this is the highest levels of NSA, was a gift to NSA. That 9/11 now would give NSA all the money that it ever wanted or wished for. And that certainly happened.
Right now, or just this week, the extension for the FISA law has passed through committee. We still have two senators, Mark Udall and Ron Wyden, who have said as much as they can, have raised a red flag that the government is interpreting the FISA law in a way that, I think in their words, I'm paraphrasing, the American public would be very surprised and dismayed to find out how they're interpreting it. Give me your sense, to the extent that you can say anything on this, what do you think they're talking about?
They're talking about a secret interpretation that we still don't know what the exact wording is regarding Section 215, legislation that's passed by Congress and signed into law. The secret interpretation, it's very clear what it is. It's extraordinarily expansive. They essentially have carte blanche requests to go to any businesses and gain the subscriber information, period, on a vast scale. That's the secret interpretation in a nutshell. Have I ever seen it? No. Has anybody else apparently ever? No, because it's apparently one of the most closely guarded secrets in the government, the secret interpretation.
Who would generate that secret interpretation?
We're talking about the executive branch itself.
And so this is something that will come
You call it a secret, consider it a secret signing statement. In essence, where the president essentially says, well, yes, I am signing this legislation into law, you know, per the Constitution. However, I'm going to grant myself the ability to reinterpret it as I see fit. And, you know, we've had many cases, especially in recent history, where presidents will sign signing statements to that effect. This is the equivalent of a secret version of that.
And so
it's enabling those instruments of power, surveillance power, and collection power within the U.S. government to essentially have carte blanche access or agreements, in secret agreements with businesses, or they go to the businesses to hand over that information. Meanwhile, on the open side of this, not the secret side, but the open side, they continue to push for legislation that essentially legalizes what they're doing illegally.
And as far as you can tell, with at least a better awareness of these issues than people who have not been exposed to what you've been exposed to, is there anybody out there who is fighting against the sort of essentially making legal what has since been illegal?
Well, first of all, you have to remember that when they're trying to make illegal what is supposedly illegal, that's often a sign that they are already doing it, as we've learned from history. But there are groups like the ACLU and like the Government Accountability Project and EPIC and EFF and DCT, a number of surveillance groups who are into openness and transparency and care about privacy rights, who are trying to make this public and trying to get to the heart of what is going on here. Unfortunately, those groups are not typically very representative of what most Americans are feeling. I think most people are not nearly as worried enough about this as they should be. And so you have these groups trying to do what they can and working very valiantly to do so. But it's falling on deaf ears. As you said, one piece of legislation that's problematic already has been approved by the Senate, and, you know, it looks like it's going to go ahead and sail on through to extend the FISA Amendments not only to extend it beyond expiration, but to expand it.
Jesselyn, the espionage case against Thomas fell apart in June of last year. Why did it fall apart, and why do you think it was brought in the first place?
I think it was brought in the first place because the administration thought that it could send a strong message to intelligence community and national security whistleblowers to shut up. It fell apart because it was based on sand. I mean, they had alleged, the Private Espionage Council alleged that Tom had improperly retained, allegedly classified information, when in point of fact, none of that information turned out to be classified after all, and it collapsed. The case collapsed in spectacular fashion. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to have deterred the Justice Department to continue its ill-advised campaign of bringing such cases in an attempt to chill not only whistleblowers but journalists.
Well, yeah, I want to get to the journalist part here, but I mean, it's clear that in bringing these cases, maybe the intent is not necessarily is not as much about carrying out justice, but as much as intimidating others within the government from providing this type of information. Thomas, what other forms of intimidation and reprisals have you been subjected to?
Well. You got a couple hours. I mean, it started after 9/11 when it became clear that I was cooperating with, you know, two 9/11. Well, originally the first 9/11 congressional investigation, it was made very clear to me that I was not to cooperate. They were waving me off. They did not want me to talk about what I knew from inside NSA. That in itself an extraordinarily chilling message. And then they began to do everything they could to pick apart the team that I led and to put me in and isolate me into a box, take away responsibilities. Ultimately, and then when I was involved in the DODIG investigation, they ultimately reorganized the entire office in which I was a part of. And I ended up with a know-nothing job. So the message was very, very clear.
And
never mind the messages being sent to all the people I work with, because I've been singled out.
And
of course, the ultimate form of that was when they actually prosecuted me. You believe me, by virtue of prosecuting me and then so publicly indicting me a couple of years ago, that really sent the message. I've talked to people privately who still work within government. They said, well, you know, if they went after you like that, the last thing I'm going to do is say anything to anybody about anything. I'm just going to keep my head down. You know, I don't want to jeopardize my retirement. I don't want to jeopardize my mortgage. I got kids in college. But they saw what happened to me and others.
And you had worked for the CIA before this. Is that correct?
Yes, I had.
And so,
yeah, plus I had also been in the military, both Air Force and Navy.
And now you are without any type of pension. And I imagine it has severely curtailed this whole public, essentially making an example of you. I imagine it's curtailed your opportunities now, even in the private sector.
Yes, because I'm considered damaged goods, radioactive, and by virtue of what's happened to me, and because I'm more than just a passing footnote in history, it would be extraordinarily challenging for me to seek employment either in areas in which I used to work. Obviously, my clearance was taken away. It's important to note for listening audience, part of all of this is simply to destroy the whistleblower's life. And they went to great lengths to do that. I mean, I don't think people fully appreciate how much the individual whistleblower, actually suffers as a result of the government putting everything they've got. And they have quite an arsenal, okay, especially when they're doing it for other reasons and not for justice, when they come after somebody in such an egregious manner as they did with me. I've got lots of debt. I have to take out a second mortgage. I spent upwards of $100,000, for a private attorney. I ended up qualifying as indigent before the federal court, which meant I now could only be represented by federal public defenders. That's just skimming the surface.
And Jesslyn, of course, the government basically got you fired from your first job outside of the government and continues to this day to attempt to get you disbarred. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And I also racked up about $100,000 in legal bills trying to fend off these attacks by the government. And while you're trying to spend all this money for lawyers to defend yourself, at the same time, you're not bringing in any kind of income stream. So it's a real double whammy on people financially to go through this. And that sends another message about why you should not even think about disclosing wrongdoing by your government.
Now, the Obama...
Very dangerous in today's...
I'm sorry, go ahead,
Thomas. Very dangerous in today's... Yeah, very dangerous in today's U.S. to be a whistleblower and right when the government is so wrong.
It's a
corrupt system. You know, it's really injustice. It's not justice by any means. I mean, what you're really facing here, we've got to get right down to brass tacks. You have this expansion, the burgeoning expansion of a national security state. National security has become the new state religion. It is sacrosanct. You do not question it. You do not violate it. And any oath you may have taken, I say oath, okay, to the Constitution, it doesn't matter. The agreements you sign with that national security state, they'll want a promise. It's essentially a loyalty oath. So you're just to shut up, do your job, follow orders, and don't worry about what you see that takes place in front of you. And yet I had an obligation, you know, under the Constitution to support and defend it and to faithfully execute the law of the land. I could not sit back and say nothing. The reason, if I did, I would have been complicit in the subversion of our own Constitution.
And Jesselyn, we have seen, and you mentioned this, an unprecedented use of the Espionage Act and an unprecedented attack on whistleblowers by the Obama administration. Why do you think they're even going further than the Bush administration did?
I think initially I thought it was so Obama could curry favor with the national security and intelligence establishments, which saw him as weak coming into office. It became pretty obvious as these cases proceeded that it was to create that precedent for going after journalists. And I think in the grand scheme of things, it's a backdoor way of creating an official Secrets Act, which we don't have in this country.
As opposed to Britain. So tell me how is it that it would set precedents for going after journalists?
Well, right now we're already seeing, in, for example, the case of Jeffrey Sterling, another CIA whistleblower who's being prosecuted. Jim Risen of the New York Times is being asked to testify against his source. So far, the lower court has ruled that there is a reporter's privilege not to have to testify against your source, and that is on appeal before the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, the most conservative court in the country. And no matter what the ruling is coming out of the Fourth Circuit, I think it may go up to the Supreme Court. And that is a huge question. 31 states have reporter reportorial shield laws, reporter shield laws, but there's no federal reporter shield law. And you can see with all of these cases, every single one of them involves a leak, a supposed leak to the media news outlet. And journalists are sprinkled throughout the indictments of these men. So I think it's very much about going after the media, and I think the media is starting to realize, like, yeah, this can have implications for us, too. You know, Jim Risen could be held in contempt of court for refusing to testify against his source if the court rules he has to do that, and his choice at that point would be to go to jail or reveal his confidential source.
That's really the threat here. I was the test case, and I knew that when it happened. I also knew, though, if I only relied on the criminal side of our justice system to defend me, that would be insufficient. I had to find a way to influence the court of public opinion. That's why, ultimately, the mainstream media, but in particular the alternative media, became so crucial in getting the word out about what was really going on. I will tell you that I've had off-the-record conversations with reporters and journalists. They said by virtue of my case alone and all the subsequent cases that have been brought against whistleblowers under the Espionage Act, that it's already sent a message. And then in many respects, journalist reporters who've enjoyed, quote-unquote, off-the-record access to, you know, some key government officials, and in some cases long-standing, they're increasingly reluctant to say anything even off the record. So the chilling effect is already happening. And that's now that becomes a form of censorship, kind of pretextual censorship. That's not what this country's all about.
Do you think that there is an increased fear within the context of the security state apparatus of things like entities like, not specifically, but maybe specifically, but entities like WikiLeaks, that the changes in technology that both allow agencies like the NSA to abuse and to break the laws and to abuse the rights of individuals in this country, at the same time they perceive a greater threat because of technology that has in some way inspired this attack on journalists, because it seems to me that you go for the higher hanging fruit when you're talking about the New York Times. It becomes that much easier to prevent any type of entities like a WikiLeaks, say. Jesselyn, what's your thoughts on that?
I think WikiLeaks has complicated this whole thing because it was such a massive disclosure that occurred during kind of the middle of these prosecutions being brought. But I think it's disingenuous of the administration to say, well, this is really about WikiLeaks, because if the administration gave a damn about people going to WikiLeaks, then the easiest solution would be to pass meaningful, effective whistleblower protection reform.
So they wouldn't necessarily have to go outside of the government if they could get the genuine protection within the context of the government.
Yes, exactly. Meaningful, effective, and enforceable whistleblower protection. We have a Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act right now that has been passed through the Senate through unanimous consent, but we'll see what happens to it. It's been pending for 12 years now. We've been going through the same song and dance, so I'd be curious to see if it gets through.
Do either one of you have
a
cent?
Problem is also,
go ahead, Thomas.
You become a whistleblower, you become a target. I'll just tell you that. This is one of the problems. I mean, I knew that many, many years ago, that by virtue, even when I was called subpoenaed, and then even when I was part of the DOD, I was again subpoenaed as a mature witness, I became a target.
And do you think that there is any type of statutory protection that could change that culture and that sense that whistleblowers are going to become such a target?
Yeah, as long as it's enforceable, but you're gonna have to have, you know, it has to be enforceable. It just can't be on paper. It has to be meaningful protection. You have to be able to have access to the courts and due process. It can't be a case where you're left out on your own, and if they decide to compromise you, like they did in my case, by turning over my name and my colleagues' names to the Department of Justice for prosecution. I mean, that's a complete compromise of the very means by which you're supposed to have a protected channel to report wrongdoing and illegalities and threats to public safety and health.
Jesselyn, I can't help but think, like, where are the senators? Where are the congresspeople? I mean, they are theoretically outside of that bureaucratic system, and they are the ones who are supposed to be offering checks. They're the ones who are sitting on the oversight committees. Without some measure of, I mean, I don't even know if it requires a certain amount of bravery, I guess, on their part. But they seem to me to be the best positioned players in all of this to make sure that these whistleblower statutes and these internal investigations are kept legitimate.
Well, you are correct. They are in the best position for that, but unfortunately, a lot of them are compromised. For example, Lisa Monaco testified to the National Security Division of Justice that the war on leaks was being egged on by the Senate Intelligence Committee, which certainly has its own interests and complicity and involvement in the warrantless wiretapping program at issue. I think the reason Congress has not been doing anything is because of their own liability. So yes, the people who are in the best position to actually have oversight and have enforcement and find out why this is happening are too compromised to do so.
Well, Thomas Drake, Jesselyn Raddick, the book is Traitor and the American Taliban. We'll put a link to that up at majority.fm. If there's anything else you think we should link to or where people can get more information, we'll link to the Human Rights, the Government Accountability Project, which covers the keeping the government accountable, particularly on this issue of whistleblowing. We will do so. But I appreciate your time today.
Thank you for covering
this
very important topic.
Everybody's coming home for lunch these days.
Hey, folks, a quick reminder. This month, the Majority Report is being sponsored by a great company which uses 1% of their revenue to fund progressive nonprofits and even more of their revenue to fund progressive political action. I'm talking about Credo Mobile, the only progressive cell phone company in the entire universe. I don't know. They're a great sponsor because, like the Majority Report, their politics are not funded by any one funder who dictates the positions they take. So they fight regressive establishment and right-wing policies without kowtowing. Credo Mobile is offering Majority Report listeners a great deal. 40% off all your first-year voice fees, true unlimited data, and a $350 credit against any costs you have in getting out of your contract with the other guys who happen to fund Republican candidates and agitate for Tea Party values. Go to credomobile.com/majority right now to get this deal before it ends on December 31st. That's credomobile.com/majority. Get yourself a great phone, get yourself a company that is agitating for your values, and help this show out. CredoMobile.com/majority.
Some people say that bowling alley's got big lanes.
Got big lanes. Got big lanes.
Some people say that bowling alleys all look the same.
Look the same. Look the same.
There's not a line that goes here that rhymes with anything.
Anything. Anything.
Had a dream last night, but I forget what it
Continuing
was.
Continuing our coverage from Netroots Nation. Joined by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. We are, in fact, in Rhode Island, Providence, Rhode Island. For the
beautiful United. Providence, Rhode Island, we might add.
Yeah, indeed. It's a wonderful opportunity for me. I grew up in Worcester, and so come down and see the rebound of Providence over the past 20 years has been pretty impressive.
Yeah, and it's good to have you back in the neighborhood, Sam.
Yes, I think, we don't need to go into the last time I was here. But Senator, there's a bunch of things I want to talk to you about. Let me start off with an issue that much of the audience is concerned about is all this talk about a grand bargain
yeah.
in the fall and about the potential for Social Security to be cut. What are you prepared to do? What is your feeling in terms of whether or not Social Security should be cut as a function of raising the retirement age or an increase in the cost of living?
My answer is extremely simple. Social Security should not be cut. In my remarks last night, I quoted a political figure from many, many, many years ago who said that it is not good to be, one ought not to be obstinate unless one ought to be. And then one ought to be unshakable. And I think Social Security progressives ought to be unshakable. The only thing that I would add by way of an addendum to that is if in the context of the grand bargain, when a lot of tectonic plates are moving around and there's lots of drama and activity, if we have the chance to lift the cap on Social Security contributions so that we can fund Social Security for 75 solid years into, as far as actuaries can see, we should seize at this chance. We should look at the grand bargain not just as a area where we need to be watchful in our defenses, but we need to be watchful for opportunities where we can move the agenda forward.
If you have the opportunity to actually get rid of the cap on Social Security, that's not enough. Would you trade cutting it for that raising of the cap, or are you simply saying that raising the cap would be it?
I think if you're looking for an opportunity, raising the cap would be a good one, particularly as people are debating what the amount of the Bush tax cuts.
But in other words, would you trade off any cuts in cost of living?
I wouldn't. Okay. I think on that one, no.
Certainly
not on the cost of living adjustment. My God, in Rhode Island, seniors went 3 years without a cost of living adjustment. We were filling in with those one-timers uh-huh. through the Recovery Act and so forth. But now they've got their first COLA in 3 years, and I can promise you all the things that seniors actually spend money on, oil, gasoline, food, pharmaceuticals, it has all gone up.
Right.
There is a real misfire between the COLA calculation and the experience of real life seniors. So I'm dead set against the so-called the chained CPI.
Okay, great. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And give me your sense of is this a legitimate concern that progressives should have? That there may be, I mean, there's been reporting that President Obama was willing to make that deal with Speaker Boehner, and we basically would have had a cut in Social Security were it not for the intransigence of Republicans in terms of any type of revenue increase whatsoever.
I think it's always a concern. Wall Street eagerly and constantly wants to get its hands on Social Security and the $2 trillion surplus that Social Security has on its books. The insurance industry always wants to get its hands onto Medicare. So these are issues that are never going to go away. I think that the defending Social Security caucus in the Senate is strong enough that we're a blocking minority that can prevent anything from happening. And I intend to exercise that function in any way that I can. I believe we're up to over 20 senators. It's pretty hard when you've got a strong group of 20 that
are
willing
to
be unshakable on that, even for the president to trade that away.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I know our listeners will be as well. Let me ask you about another recent story that was in the news. I'm talking about the kill list that the president has is maintaining using drones, essentially.
Yeah.
One of the things that came out of that, I mean, I find many aspects of the story disturbing. One of the things that came out of it was that the Justice Department has essentially said that due process doesn't necessarily have to be judicial in this instance, particularly specifically in the killing of an American citizen abroad. Give me your perspective on that.
I think this is an area that needs two things. We need better congressional oversight of this area, and then we need to develop a clearer notion of what the appropriate level of due process is. If an American has taken up arms against the United States, is on a battlefield shooting at U.S. soldiers in a battlefield overseas, we have no hesitation in the context of that battlefield conduct to shoot that soldier or any other enemy soldier. As you work your way more back towards specific targeted killings outside of a battlefield context, it gets more and more challenging to figure out how you provide the, as you said, due process necessary to make Americans comfortable that that terrible power is never misused.
I mean, do you have a sense that we know that there was a essentially a finding by the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice that allows this program to continue, and it was found legal. Do you have a sense of what is in that letter? In other words, we have essentially a secret law that says this is okay, but I'm not allowed to look at it anywhere. Senators?
I fought many battles with the Bush Justice Department to get access to the Office of Legal Counsel, the OLC memos that supported the torture program, the warrantless wiretapping program, and other excesses of that administration. And I can remember being taken in and told that I could read them but not have copies, that I couldn't have them brought to my office. I had to go to the executive branch in order to read them. We battled over whether I was allowed to take notes
while I was reading them. Is there any justification for something like this?
Well, there is, and the argument is that a president has the right to get advice from his lawyers or her lawyers, And like any attorney-client relationship, that's kind of sacrosanct. And people who might wish the president ill politically don't get to jump into that conversation any more than a prosecutor gets to jump into the conversation between a defense lawyer and the defense lawyer's legal counsel. Where that begins to change is where the opinion isn't just a legal opinion being provided to the president, but is in effect an administrative act of the administration that is now the basis for authorizing activities. And there's a tension between those two that I don't think we've resolved very well yet from a point of view of our congressional oversight.
It seems to break down a little bit that someone could rely on a memo from the OLC as if it were a statute and use that as a get out of jail free card
yeah.
or a you can't prosecute me card in the future. But at the same time, it's also when in the terms of it being protected correspondence, if you
yeah.
will, it's merely advice.
Well, and the probably worst case of that ever was in the Bush administration, Gonzalez Attorney General, Office of Legal Counsel opinions that authorized the Bush torture program as one of the first people outside of the administration to read those. I was really horrified at the quality of the work.
And how can we say that it authorizes something if it's merely advice?
If it's merely advice.
I mean, isn't that
so
the problem?
That's the point. It's sort of at the boundary between being just legal advice to somebody versus being an administrative authorization in its own right. And in that case, clearly, the quality of the legal work had been degraded in order to reach the outcome that they wanted to.
So,
and so that's kind of the worst-case scenario in which not only is it... just to find out what's going on, because it's in effect an administrative authorization that you want access to be able to read those things, but also, frankly, if they're tanking the opinion in order to get a preordained result, you want to be able to have a look at it, be able to make an impartial assessment as to whether that underlying legal opinion is really legitimate or whether it's results-oriented legal opinion making.
And so have senators had the opportunity to see that OLC document that the Obama Justice Department has produced authorizing these kill lists? And
I am not aware of it.
And so let me – I want to move on. Is there any attempt in the Senate to – is anybody asking to see that document?
To the extent that's happening, it would be happening through the Intelligence and Armed Services Committee leadership in the first instance.
Okay. And I imagine that is obviously sort of secret stuff.
That's about as far as I can go.
I understand. But I appreciate your at least walking us up to that line. I want to talk also recently, of course, we've just seen what may be a sort of preview in Wisconsin of the type of overwhelming amounts of money
yeah.
that our elections are going to be subject to in the future. I don't know that we'll see that type of disparity in those type of dollars proportionately on a national scale, but we've just seen the recipe for corporate power that might want to focus on a congressional race
yeah.
or a senatorial race in a small
yeah.
state, or obviously a governor's race.
Yeah.
Give me your sense of the opportunity that we might have to overturn, let's say, Citizens United. I know that you filed a brief here, at least in regards to the Montana case.
Yeah. I think the Supreme Court needs to reconsider Citizens United. I don't think the judges who decided Citizens United, the five Republicans, want to reconsider Citizens United. They, I think, wanted to have the effect that they have had of opening unlimited corporate cash, which has helped the Republican Party in elections, including blowing out the recall movement in Wisconsin with 7-1, I'm told, spending advantages.
I think
so,
I might literally be going up every day as more money is sort of discovered having been soaked into
yeah,
Wisconsin.
So I don't think they want to overturn it. But I also think that these are people whose reputations are at stake here. And if they believe that Citizens United is going to go onto the dustbin of Supreme Court decisions, along with Lochner versus New York, the anti-progressive decisions, along with Plessy versus Ferguson, which said that separate but equal was okay for people of color. You know, it was Justice Harlan and Justice Holmes and their dissents in those cases that have stood the test of time and that we're proud of now, and the earlier decisions are, frankly, disgraceful. And I think that there's cause now for concern on their part that Citizens United is going to be such a disgraceful decision. And it's important to ramp up the pressure on that, to remind Americans how much they had to bend the rules of appellate decision-making to get to Citizens United, how badly wrong they were as a matter of the facts that they presumed to exist that and that they presumed would exist. Well, the two big ones are that the super PACs would be independent of candidates. That's turned out to be complete hogwash. They have the same fundraisers. They have the same staff. The candidate goes and fundraises for the super PAC. The super PAC has no purpose other than that campaign. You had Santorum win the Minneapolis primary with no presence of him or his campaign, just his super PAC. So the notion of independence from the candidate has been completely demolished. The other is disclosure.
Right.
The Supreme Court decision was based on that you'd know and you could evaluate, oh, this is those coal barons spending money. I'll take that into account in evaluating this negative commercial that I'm seeing. That hasn't happened either. Half of the money that's been spent through these super PACs has been anonymous, hidden, secret source cash. So they've just been so wrong in so many ways, and they're so off base with the American public that there's hope that their sense of reputation will bring at least some of them back, even if their partisan desires were satisfied by the decision that they made.
So if I'm understanding what you're saying is that the if they, not necessarily all five, but if one or two of the five
have a little crisis of conscience or a fear of reputation loss
that down the road, this is going to get overturned. It's going to look a lot worse for them in the history books. And I guess that hopefully that weighs on some level with the, at least some of the justices.
I think they're sensitive to their reputations, and I think it's pretty clear that at least the first draft of history as being written by folks like Jeffrey Toobin, who I think is probably the single most significant chronicler of this era's Supreme Court, that first draft of history that's being written is not flattering to Justice Roberts and not flattering to his fellow Republican colleague judicial activists on that court.
Right, and Justice Kennedy really staked a lot on that notion of disclosure, which, of course, was something that he presumed would happen but never did. And I imagine that...
They walked into a bit of a trap. First of all, Supreme Courts aren't supposed to make findings of fact at all. It's not part of the job of an appellate tribunal to do that. So when they ventured into fact-finding in this case, they were crossing a line. Then they ventured into fact-finding in an area where they have no expertise because none of them's ever run for an office before, ever. I think it's the first time we've ever had a Supreme Court with zero election experience. And then third, the findings of fact that they made have been just totally disproven because they never had a record because of the weird way they asked the question in the Supreme Court. They never had a trial court record and then a, you know, sort of thoughtful appellate court decision to work off of. They were starting from scratch from this position of ignorance about elections. And had there been a record, I think they would have been in a better position.
Do you think this is a good argument in the event that President Obama is in a position to appoint the next Supreme Court justice? Do you think there's a good argument for someone who has not been a judge?
Oh, absolutely. I think the problem is that we've let that court become staffed entirely by folks who are in the, for want of a better word, it's the judicial monastery. And within that judicial monastery, the Republicans have worked very hard to staff it with people who have a specific purpose to advance a specific agenda. And so I think if there had been one of those Republicans who'd actually been in an election, they would have known how foolish their decision was going to look, that the finding of fact they made was not only wrong to make the finding, but wrong as a matter of fact. It just was plain, they found something as a fact that wasn't a fact, and that is that No amount of corporate spending could possibly cause either corruption or the appearance of corruption in an election. It's a preposterous notion.
It paints a rather sort of terrifying vision of just how thick and opaque that bubble that they must live in
is.
I mean, and it's sort of terrifying, the idea, you know, because this is, we're not talking about some type of arcane, specialized aspect of plumbing or surgery or
I've been in politics.
Of anthropology.
I've been a prosecutor. I've prosecuted public corruption cases. It's a very short leap to say, look, if you're going to allow anonymous corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money in elections, the issue isn't just how they spend it. The issue is how they threaten to spend it. The scariest thing from a public corruption point of view about Citizens United isn't the coal industry running an ad against somebody someplace. It's the coal industry going into their office with their lobbyists and saying to them, here's the ad, pal. We're going to put $5 million behind it in your home state. Nobody will know we have our hands on it because it's going to come through Americans for Peace, Prosperity, and Puppies.
Right.
And you're never going to be able to trace it back to us. And it trashes you. And the only way you can dodge that bullet is by voting right with us. And if the person chickens out and votes right, they will have been corrupted and they won't be a single election expenditure. There'll be nothing to trace. And the fact that the Supreme Court couldn't think through to that step is a very clear sign of how opaque that bubble is. Anybody who's been a prosecutor, anybody who's been in elective office would easily see that when you give corporations that power to do something, you give them the power to threaten that same thing, and that becomes an unpoliced area of massive, massive opportunity for corruption.
Is that the biggest problem that we have? Not just in terms, the one way to view it is that this is an electoral, this corrupts the electoral process. The way you've described it sort of describes the sort of corruption of the legislative process.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are there other elements that corrupt that legislative process?
That's the worst, the ability to threaten. I mean, before Citizens United, if a corporation was mad at you, it could say, well, we're going to max out our PAC against you,
right?
$10,000. And then our executives are going to host fundraisers and raise money against you. Okay, you know, perhaps not the news you want to hear if you're a candidate, but it doesn't ruin your whole day.
Right.
Whereas if somebody comes in and says, $5 million is going up against you in your next election, it's 100% negative track, it destroys your reputation every way we can think of, and it's all because you're not voting right, so change your tune and we'll pull our punch. That's a very different threat. And when you open up the floodgates, you open up the threat.
And presumably that threat comes also with a lobbyist who gives you all the good reasons as to why you should be voting that way.
You don't even really have to make the threat in some circumstances, because candidates will become so attuned to it being out there that they'll pre-flinch. It's implicit.
Let me ask you about another thing that that we have in the news.
But if you want corporate ownership of the political process, that's
this
not
is a
such
great
a bad
way to
idea.
Do it. Turning to foreign policy, we have a situation in Syria which seems to be, it's been deteriorating and continuing to deteriorate.
Yeah.
We have a situation now where it could be something that's starting to spill into Lebanon. It could possibly spill into Jordan. I'm curious as to what you think that we should be doing, both in the short and mid and long term.
I think we face the same problem that we faced in Libya, which is that if we get out ahead of what the Arab community is willing to tolerate, there is enormous blowback. And we have to work in support of the Arab League, because otherwise we set off a counter-reaction about American imperialism, unwelcome intrusion, and, of course, the if-you-break-it-you-own-it problem. So I think it's really important for the Obama administration to continue to work with the Arab community to put as much pressure as possible on this guy, Assad, who is, at this point, I think, becoming one of the great war criminals of modern history. And I don't want to talk about Syria without also saying a word about Marie Colvin, the reporter who was an American woman who was killed in Homs, targeted evidently by the Syrian forces to her sat phone because her reporting was so effective, reporting on children who were dying from shrapnel wounds without medicine or anesthesia, without doctors able to provide for their care. So as terrible as the situation is in Syria, it's also been a chance for members of your profession, of the press, to demonstrate what can only be categorized as heroism. And Marie was a friend from college, and a lot of us miss her very keenly.
And do you think that, so in the event that it does, the Arab League does get out in front, and there is a sort of a clear pathway in the United Nations for some type of intervention in the event that no one can convince Assad to simply go away. What do you feel?
Nobody had to convince Gaddafi to go away.
Well, I mean, indeed, but what do you feel about the fact that the actions that we took were not authorized by the Congress? By the Congress. In regards to Libya, does the president have unilateral authority to engage? And is that really kinetic movement or whatever it was described? Or
I think in an ideal world, I'd like to see Congress authorizing that. But when you look at the timing and you look at the importance of these issues, and you look at the extent to which the Congress has been tied in knots by Republicans seeking to thwart Obama for the purpose of thwarting the president and denying him even victories that they might agree with, I'm sympathetic to the president's position. I think it was important that we provided the support we did in Libya, which included intelligence, enormous amount of signals and navigation and other assistance, coordination of flights and so forth, and actually flying sorties ourselves. But all of that was made possible because you also had Qatari jets flying, and you had, you know, Arab flags right involved in that, and you had an Arab-supported outcome. And I think that's we just have to realize the limits of being America in the Arab world, and as much as we can coordinate, we can't get ahead of our where the Arab community will tolerate.
I understand. All right. Well, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, thank you so much for sitting down with us in Providence.
Beautiful Providence, may I say. Indeed. People are loving it here. It's a funky, hip town. The sun is gleaming down on the rivers, and people are having a wonderful time here.
I got to say it is. I grew up 40 minutes away from here, and you guys have the wonderful Blackstone Canal, and we paved it over in Worcester. We're jealous. But
thank you, Sam.
Sticks and stones may break his bones, but conservative lies will only make him stronger. Sam Seder.
What you're about to listen to is Rush Limbaugh's inner demons, his inner misogyny coming out, despite the fact that he lost hundreds of thousands of dollars of advertising, despite the fact that he got kicked off a bunch of affiliates because of his blatant misogyny. It cannot help itself but to creep out of his massive shell. And then what you're going to now see, and just here, if you see how he stops himself in mid-sentence, as he's getting an IM probably from his producer who says, whoa, 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 you got to back off on this. And then you'll hear how he tries to salvage it at the end. But here is rampant misogynist Rush Limbaugh, who cannot help himself.
Marina, thanks much. Carl never heard of this. Somewhere in California. How are you, sir?
Oh, fine, sir. That's Leona Valley.
Leona?
Yes.
Okay, that's not spelled that way. Okay.
You know, my thought is, going back to the problem of Obamacare and going back to the problem of how Obama got into the White House, I was looking at the Constitution the other day thinking about when we repealed the 18th Amendment. And I thought the 26th Amendment, which gave us the right to vote for 18-year-olds, if we're going to look back on this in 10 or 15 years and think, this is where the problem started, we would not have, I mean, the dynamic was set up to have somebody that was this foolish get elected.
Nah, I can do one better than that.
Well, you know what?
Got the right to vote, when it all went downhill. Because that's when votes started being cast with emotion and maternal instincts that government ought to reflect.
Well, you know, before 21...
Okay, stop for a second. Did that sound like a joke to you? No, I could do one better. The electorate really got bad when we gave women the vote. And that's when they started to... they voted with emotion, and when government became maternal, try and see if you can see the comedic construct there. No, I don't think you can. But, however, he stops. He gets that I am. He lets the caller speak.
The 18-year-olds, they only know their only financial knowledge is, hey, I need money, I'll ask mom for it. And with the state of education these days, I'm not sure there's that much history or government taught.
Yeah, look, I'm joking about the women's vote. I just a little frustrated here. But look, the young people don't vote enough. That's I appreciate what you're saying. I don't think it's quite applicable yet.
Beep, beep, backing it up. That is the sound of a misogynist who realizes, oops, I can't go there for another 6 to 8 months. And, I mean, just to understand what he's saying here, let's assume for the moment, let's give Rush Limbaugh, for the sake of argument, which I don't think is true, but for the sake of argument, that women are more emotional and more maternal. And have a maternal perspective on things and a more emotional perspective. Why wouldn't we allow for the attributes of 50% of our population to in any way implicate society? The guy hates women. He cannot help himself. And he's also apparently a really bad joke teller.
The caller was a pretty big asshole, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Blaming 18-year-olds. How dare they have a say in whether they go off to war or
you just die in war, douchebag. You don't get to vote. You don't know your finances yet. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And just because your experience was when you were 18, mommy and daddy were there to give you money, doesn't mean everybody's experience is the same, dick.
Todd Akin, who on Friday had announced that poor kids really should not be in the business of getting free lunches at school, certainly not from the federal government. We should leave it up to states, which are cutting off, which are firing 200,000 teachers, which are firing cops, which are firing firefighters, which are completely cutting back and involved in austerity programs. We should leave it to them to provide free lunches for poor kids in school. And if the kids can't eat, I guess they can suck on their thumb as a way of getting some form of nutrition and getting their education. But apparently Todd Akin huddled with his campaign officials after he said that, and looked around the table, and they all said, boss, that's pretty crazy. Yeah, it's heartless. Yeah, in many respects, it's arguably offensive to people, but you got to top that. So Todd Akin went on to a program in Missouri where he is running against Senator Claire McCaskill. KTVI TV interview. was posted on Sunday, and he said to himself, this is where I go from crazy town to completely bat crap crazy town. This is the question that he has asked. This is a real gotcha question.
Of the importance of all of us.
Okay, so if an abortion could be considered in a case of, say, a tubal pregnancy or something like that, what about in the case of rape? Should it be legal or not?
Well, you know, people always want to try and make that as one of those things. Well, how do you slice this particularly tough sort of ethical question? It seems to me, first of all, from what I understand from doctors, that's really rare. If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down. But let's assume that maybe that didn't work or something. You know, I think there should be some punishment, but the punishment ought to be in the rapist and not attack.
And he goes on to say not attacking the child. Now, let me just start with this. The follow-up interview was not even about abortion or rape. I mean, the follow-up question. So kudos to that reporter at the Jacko Report.
He's apologized since. He said he had a brain fart.
I would imagine.
That was his exact words.
Now, it's also understandable that you would be in complete and total shock that a candidate for the Senate in the United States at this day and age would say something like that. Let's break this down for a second, because to be fair, Todd Akin says that he misspoke. But I don't know what the frick he thought he was misspeaking about. I mean, I don't understand even, like, when he says he misspoke, did he use the wrong language? Or did he just go back to Wikipedia and find out, oh, there's no such thing as legitimate rape, and that the female body does not have ways to try to shut that whole thing down? And this is what he understood from doctors. So maybe when he said he misspoke, he said, I didn't misunderstand this from doctors. What I meant to say was, I understood this from right-wing nut jobs, from Tea Partiers, or I understood this from complete and utter morons who don't have a capacity to have an intellectual thought that they haven't derived from some type of machine which spits out fantastical words from the Bible. Or maybe he said, like, from what I understand, not from doctors, I misspoke. What I understand was from one of the rocks in my garden that speaks to me in the middle of the night. If it's a legitimate rape, I don't know what that means. I don't know what it could mean. In a million years, I know what the female body has ways to try that shut that whole thing down means. It means either some part of the woman's physiology has the capacity to know that there is rapist sperm there and control their eggs in such a way that the eggs say, like, okay, that's not... And that's shocking. Never mind for a moment how offensive this is. This is a guy who actually has the intellectual capacity to believe this. Try and come up with something else based upon this precedent that this guy could not believe. What insane belief could this guy not hold now that he has set the bar so low as to believe whatever garbage he wants to believe? This is just insane. And at the same time, it's not really out of character for the Republican Party. There's always a lighter side and a darker side to Rick Santorum. The lighter side, of course, is that he purposely named his money bomb with the acronym CUM. That's funny and enjoyable. And then there's the darker side, where he basically tells rape victims to make lemonade out of lemons. Watch this video.
But let me ask you this. Do you really believe in every case it should be totally wrong? in the sense that I know that you believe even in cases of rape and incest, and, but you know, you've got two daughters. You know, if you had a daughter that came to you who'd been raped and was pregnant and was begging you to let her have an abortion, would you really better look her in the eye and say no as her father?
I would do what every father would do, is to try to counsel your daughter to do the right thing.
It's an almost impossibly hypothetical thing to ask you, but there will be people in that position who may share your religious values.
It's not a matter of religious values.
And they're looking at their daughter saying, how can I deal with this? Because if I make her have this baby, isn't it just going to ruin her life?
Well, you can make the argument that if she doesn't have this baby, if she kills her child, that too could ruin her life.
I wonder if when Santorum's wife decided to induce pregnancy when their fetus was 23 weeks old, ostensibly to save her life, I wonder if that has ruined her life. Someone should ask him about that.
And this is not an easy choice. I understand that. As horrible as the way that daughter and son was created, it still is her child. And whether she has that child or she doesn't, it will always be her child, and she will always know that. And so to embrace her and to love her and to support her and get her through this very difficult time, I've always, you know, I believe and I think, you know, the right approach is to accept this horribly created in the sense of rape, but nevertheless gift. In a very broken way, but gift of human life, and accept what God is giving to you. As you know, we have to, in lots of different aspects of our life, we have horrible things happen. I can't think of anything more horrible, but nevertheless, we have to make the best out of a bad situation.
How do you equate?
That is making the best.
It's the gift of rape. The gift of rape. Now, I think that if a woman who is raped wants to carry to term their pregnancy and give birth to a child, she feels comfortable doing that, more power to her. But the idea that Rick Santorum is sitting there and saying that, you know, when you get raped and you give birth to that child, don't look at that child as a product of rape. Look at it as like one of the happy products of the rape. The rape wasn't all bad. Some of it was good. And, you know, if there's somebody who can do that, great. But the idea that you would mandate that. The real question I would like to see Rick Santorum ask is, what if his wife was raped? What if his wife was raped? And Rick Santorum raised that child as his own. That lemonade that would come out of that rape.
Look at it on the bright side. You could have been raped, not gotten pregnant, and nothing good would have come out of it.
That's right. That's right. What if you were raped and the rapist used protection? That would have been horrible. I would love to see Rick Santorum have to sell that to the American public, not just the people in the Republican Party. Let's go to Brian calling from New Jersey. Welcome to the program, Brian.
Hey, Sam. This is your daily reminder that you're a hypocrite and sheep.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that, Brian. You want to be more explicit?
Oh, no. It's me again. It's your old friend, Jim.
Hi, Jim. Do you have anything else to add?
I still think
you don't have to lie, incidentally, Jim. I mean, we don't have to lie to get on the program.
You ask what?
You don't have to lie to get on the program.
Oh, I thought you'd kind of be blocking my calls from now on.
No, I'm just waiting for you to say something that's reasonably intelligent.
You're waiting for me to say something reasonably intelligent. You said that if both candidates were going to build concentration camps, you would support whoever was building less, and you want me to say something reasonably intelligent.
Yes.
You are a fool. You pundits are what's wrong with this country. You and Rush Limbaugh and Bill Maher and Glenn Beck, you're all cut from the same cloth. You are spreading.
Well, then let me ask you this, Jim. Jim, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this. Where do I line up to get their cash?
Where do you line up to get their cash? It doesn't matter where you line up. You're all the same. You're all causing problems for this country.
I am causing problems for this country. What problem am I causing, Jim?
As I said, you and Limbaugh and Maher and Beck, you're all...
Well, let's just focus
idea.
On me.
I'm right.
Let's just focus on me.
Idea.
Let's just focus on me. What problem am I causing? Not the other ones. Just me.
You're pushing the idea that you're always right, everyone has to agree with you, and anyone who disagrees with you in the slightest way is evil or stupid.
Now, wait a second, Jim. Now, Jim, hold on for a second. Let's just replay for a second. You call up to tell me this is your daily reminder to me that I am a hypocrite and a sheep. And now you are saying that the problem with me is that I call people who call me in, and then you also say that I'm a fool. And then you tell me that the problem with me is that I think that people who disagree with me are what?
All right. It does seem like a bit of a double standard. I know, but I am not willing to...
Would you call that hypocrisy, Jim?
I wouldn't act this way to you if you didn't act this way towards other people who disagree with you.
Like who?
I know plenty of liberals who have policies I disagree with, but I get along well with them because they are social about it. They don't go to attacks. I know plenty of conservatives who have policies I disagree with.
Jim, are you the guy who writes me all the curse-laden emails?
Maybe I am, maybe I'm not.
You know, Jim, I'll tell you what happens at this point, okay? What happens at this point is I get IMs and emails saying, Jim's not real. Jim is a fake caller. Come on, Sam, give up the ghost. But, Jim, I want you to tell my audience that you are, in fact, real, that we didn't plan this in any way, that the things you're saying I haven't scripted for you, that you're actually saying these things.
I am. I'm a real person, and I'm fed up with you and the rest of your ilk.
Okay. Anything else?
Yeah. Keep supporting the lesser of two evils, and our country will keep going down the tubes.
And, all right. I don't know what to say. I hope Jim goes and listens to that again. And I hope those people on Twitter who are like, you were really mean to that caller the other day.
You got him.
Maybe I am, and maybe I'm not the person sending you all these curse-laden emails.
You got him pretty good. That was he was caught up in his own web of lies.
I don't even know how to react to that, but that was pretty good. Morella, I think Jim was coming out of the pool of your libertarian friend, Sam. He gave himself away when he said, when he made his lesser of two evils comments. Apparently, he resents you for voting for Obama as a lesser evil. This is how, according to him, you cause ruin to the world. You invite this type of trouble when you invite your conservative or libertarian listeners to call in. They join and listen in and become enraged at what they hear. Yeah, well, I encourage Jim to call back in and anybody else to call back in. But here's what I would ask. And, of course, I have no way of knowing. And we only screen to just get your name and location so I don't have to go like, hey, 570, where are you calling from? Because I don't know all the area codes. That's all we ask for. Rather not discuss what you want to talk about? Whatever. You have multiple callers on the phone. I want to talk to somebody who's talking about the topic, but I'm willing to talk to any of them. But here's what I would ask. Try to have an intelligent comment. Just try. If you don't get there, you don't get there. But try. Make the slightest bit of effort. You're aware that you're picking up the phone. You're aware that you're dialing 646-257-3920. Just have an idea of what you're going to say and say it out loud before you call so you can see if it doesn't sound ridiculous even to you.
This doesn't count for people calling to ask questions because there's no such thing as a stupid question.
That's right. Of course, there's no such thing as a stupid question.
And Sam's even cool with you calling up and giving calling him every name in the book, too, as long as you follow it up with an intelligent comment.
Of course. Left Coast Marcus. Hey, Jim, Sam doesn't insult his callers, but I will. You are a moron. Look, I will occasionally insult my callers. Usually it takes... it takes quite a bit. I mean, if you can find another show that has allowed for as wide a disparity of opinion as people will call in with. And I think for the most part, I'm pretty respectful of it. I may disagree.
Most of these shows that take callers, you know, if someone called in like that, the producer would cut it off, or they would just hang up on the person.
Yeah,
you at least have the decency to let them spill what they want to spill.
Decency. I mean, it's the, you know, the what Jim is obviously got is some type of misplaced anger. I mean, the notion that somehow I am to blame for the ills of the Jim, call back in, tell us what the ills are that I am responsible for. Country, incidentally, must have been doing great before 2004 when I didn't have a radio show. And all I was doing was directing Gary Busey.
I think the country's better since, actually.
Actually, there's a very good argument that... that show with Gary Busey did more harm to the country than anything I've ever done by talking about politics.
Such an apple.